This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Thousands of people marched on Friday evening in St. Paul, Minnesota, after the acquittal of Officer Geronimo Yanez in the shooting death of Philando Castile. The not guilty verdict was met with disbelief in a case that many had hoped was an open and shut case of unjustifiable police brutality. And then, just 2 days later, in Seattle, Washington, another brutal police killing took place, this time of a pregnant Black woman named Charlena Lyles. The 30-year-old Lyles was with her children when police fatally shot her, saying afterward that she had a knife. Lyles had called police for help to investigate a burglary. Her case is reminiscent of that of Corinne Gaines, a Black mother who was killed by police in her home less than a year ago in Baltimore County, Maryland. Police killings are an age-old American story, but heightened documentation and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement increased the expectations of Americans for the justice system to hold police accountable. While that did not work very much under President Obama, in the era of Donald Trump, it appears even less likely that police will face any consequences for the continued killings of African Americans. Joining me to discuss this is my guest, Mark Anthony Johnson. He's the Director of Health and Wellness for Dignity and Power Now, also a member of the Movement for Black Lives Policy Platform Leadership Team. Welcome to the program, Mark Anthony.
Thank you, Sonali, for having me.
So first, let's begin with the Seattle story, a horrific story of this a young mother pregnant with her children. And the script sadly sounds familiar. She called the police for help and ended up getting killed herself. Does this story fit the pattern of what we have unfortunately come to expect in terms of interactions between police and Black Americans?
It definitely fits the pattern, Sonali. And I think what's so hard is that there is not only a pattern of law enforcement harming, killing Black people who have some type of mental health condition, some type of mental health disability, but also incarcerating folks who have mental health disabilities. And so on the spectrum of police interactions, I think there's a bigger question, right? Had this woman survived this interaction with law enforcement, what would have happened to her in terms of being in custody? Because clearly she was seen as the enemy. And we see that across the United States. You know, we see that here in Los Angeles, we have the largest jail system in the world, and also the largest mental health facility in the country, which is Twin Towers Jail. And we know that our folks are not only subject to violence on the outside, such as what happened in Seattle, but also subject to tremendous amounts of human rights violations on the inside. And so the pattern is part of a broader structure in which we believe that law enforcement should not be in any way first responders to our folks and our loved ones who have some type of mental health condition. And, you know, we see that even when folks are asking for help, what happens is that we become the targets.
Right. And it's not even necessarily clear what this young mother, how she might have been acting at the time. She might have been perfectly lucid. And then, you know, the media reports. And in fact, I actually want to put up the news headline of a local newspaper for our TV audience. Local newspaper covering this story had a headline of what happened in Seattle. Mother with knife killed by police was pregnant and had mental health issues, family says. Mother with knife are the first three words of this headline.
Right.
And then you have the issue of mental health. Shouldn't the headline, I mean, just sort of wondering, if this woman had been a white woman and had been killed by police, wouldn't the headline have read, police kill mother who called them for help?
Definitely. And I think it's indicative of how Black people are described and framed in the United States. How we are considered dangerous, our ability to harm others, our assumption that we are violent, those are the things that are headlined when in fact we're the ones who are on the receiving end of so much harms. And we also know that it's very common that folks who have mental health disabilities, and for many of us who I'm sure are listening now, have loved ones who have some type of mental health condition or disability. You know that navigating the system that we have now in terms of healthcare is hard and difficult. And so the ability to get help and to get resources is more and more challenging, especially in the context that we see now where there's a tremendous attack on access to healthcare, including mental health
Right.
care.
And we also know systemic racism can feed a depression and feed, unfortunately, feed the kind of existing conditions that people might have, right? When people who are
Right.
victims of systemic racism constantly all their lives have worse health outcomes.
Definitely,
Yeah.
definitely. And we know that. It's proven, it's fact, and we didn't need research to show it. Some people do, and that's sad in this country, but
Yeah.
unfortunately, here's where we are. Another woman has lost her life
Yeah.
because of that complex assault on our well-being.
Also, she had a knife. If you suspect that somebody is coming to burglarize your house and you don't have a gun in your home, which of course is not something that I would ever advise anyone to necessarily have, but that's just my personal opinion. I would reach for a knife, and I've done so. You hear a sound in your house, you're all alone. Maybe you're just with your children, you feel alone. You go and find the biggest, sharpest knife you can in your house, and you arm yourself with it, and then you call the police. And it could be that this is, we don't know exactly what the facts were, but it could be that from the surface of it, sounds like what this young mother might have done. I mean, how could you just sort of wonder, couldn't police have used non-lethal force if they felt threatened against a pregnant woman with a knife?
Definitely. And I think underlying that is also some really clear messaging that Black women do not have the right to defend themselves.
Yeah.
Black women do not have the right to really defend their families and who they consider their families. And yes, there are always, in every case, other alternatives and other means of achieving safety and de-escalating harm in a situation and getting the facts in the situation. And clearly, this isn't one of those moments.
Mark Anthony, doesn't this also send the absolutely terrifying message to African Americans that if you are in trouble, if you think your house is being broken into, you can't really call the cops because if you do, ch chances are you might end up being the one killed.
Yes,
What
definitely.
is
And
the
I
impact
think,
of public safety overall?
well, I think this is the discussion and this is the fundamental question, right? And I think the acquittal of the officer that shot and killed Philando Castile also demonstrates the same thing. You know, the question is always, did the officer have some reasonable belief or reasonable assumption to fear for his life or his safety, and therefore could use lethal force. And those assumptions are always going to be in place because of everything we've talked about already on this call. And so a lot of us in the Movement for Black Lives are talking about really what is the answer? The answer is to divest from what we know as law enforcement, from incarceration, and into other means of public safety, into alternative institutions, into things that we know actually work: jobs, healthcare, education, really getting controls of our local budgets and putting them where we know we will get help and where we know have real impacts on making our communities safer.
Right. And I want to have that broader conversation, but let's also focus for a minute on the case of Philando Castile, this man in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area in Minnesota, who was basically killed in his car by Officer Geronimo Yanez after he did the right thing by informing the officer.
That's
In a very reasonable way that he was armed with a gun for which he had a permit. It's really interesting because we've seen defenders of the Second Amendment and the NRA talk about the right of people to be armed, and it seems as though that only applies to white people, that a person who had a permit for a gun who was black somehow was considered a danger to police. And we have seen armed white men who have already killed people being taken into custody and being, you know, allowed to get a burger on the way to jail, survive their interactions with police. And not so for Philando Castile. And still this officer was found not guilty. I just have no words.
I hear you. It's deeply frustrating. I don't know if that captures the feeling. It's deeply tragic. I think about it and I just feel angry. And it's hard to really even just articulate once again, you know, this state that we're in, where these laws, the protections that people are fighting for, do not apply to Black folks, even when we do the right thing. And I think this is really helpful to really push us to think about, you know, it's not about how you're dressed. It's not about what steps you take. It's not about the tone of voice. Those aren't the things. What's operating is a system that really does not apply the same protections, the same human rights standards, the same civil rights standards to Black people.
Right. We basically are seeing from these incidents one after the other that having any kind of a reasonable, you know, sense, state of being doesn't work for Black people. That if you were any other color, your reaction would be seen as perfectly reasonable, to inform the officer you're armed, to be in your own house with a knife because you thought somebody was breaking in. But when the police encounter Black people doing this, they are seen as dangerous and a threat to their lives. I mean, we've heard of driving while Black, but maybe we should start talking about existing while Black. Mark Anthony, how do we see these incidents in a broader light? Because we see them one after the other. We see them trickling in. There's a steady drip, right? It's not as though there's these sorts of killings happening, you know, dozens of times a day. They happen one a week, one every other week. Does that sort of undermine the outrage that society in general should be feeling?
Well, you asked about like what, you know, what is it that folks can do, and what are we actually looking at? What are we talking about?
I mean,
and
we should be looking at this as a pattern, right? In a broad sense, not as individual incidents. I should sort of clarify what I was trying
to say. And I think it's not simply, and this is what I was saying earlier, that it's not simply the acts of the killings, right? The killings exist on a spectrum of law enforcement interactions. And so I think it's important to see that for our folks who survive law enforcement interactions and are ending up in custody are experiencing a whole other spectrum of violence at the hands of law enforcement, a whole other spectrum of violations of human rights. And so seeing the whole picture is part of what the Movement for Black Lives has been trying to do and really push and really uplift all the work that folks are doing around the country to see the whole picture and articulate the ways in which we can move ourselves out of this pattern of being narrowly focused on what's happening to our folks and see the whole picture. And so for us, what we're saying is that things like getting political power, building alternative institutions in our communities, reparations, having those types of conversations are helpful for us to really think about how do we start to tackle the complexity of the spectrum of state violence. And for us in Los Angeles, it's really important because what we're looking at is not only, you know, the two deadliest law enforcement agencies in the country are the LAPD and the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department.
And when you say deadliest, do you mean simply in terms of statistics of how the violence of their interactions?
How many people die a year because of a law enforcement interaction by the sheriffs and LAPD? It's they are those two, LAPD first and Sheriff's Department second. And so, but post that, they're also the incarcerating people at tremendous rates. And so really looking at how do we divest from those institutions, divest from law enforcement, and move resources away into our communities. And I think one thing that's really important right now, particularly in this context of Jeff Sessions, who is looking at reviewing Department of Justice consent decrees and really weakening federal tools that we've used to beat back, if you will, the violence against our communities, and looking at the ways in which, you know, people like Sheriff Clark have been tapped for federal positions, like the Department of Homeland Security liaison with local law enforcement, an entire infrastructure is being built to allow more of these things to happen. And so for us, honing in on really divestment from law enforcement and divestment from jails in particular, prisons in particular, are going to be really critical in this moment.
So let's talk about the broader context. Under President Obama, under Attorneys General, both Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch, we started to see some lip service. We started to see some federal investigations. And we started to see an addressing of federal prisons and the you know, having conversations about the need to reduce the federal prison population. Is all of that being reversed under the Sessions leadership of the DOJ and the Trump administration?
I think they're definitely trying to reverse it. And we see that with Sessions, you know, giving DAs the green light to go harder on drug-related offenses and drug-related incarcerations, really pushing people to give the maximum sentences. And we've seen that rhetoric being pushed. And also, I think what we're also seeing is a greater level of complexity around harming our folks. And what I mean by that is right now there's a pretty serious attack on healthcare in the United States. And we see that one of the few places, because of the ways in which healthcare has been divested from in our communities, because of the ways in which mental health infrastructure in particular has been divested from in Black communities, that one of the few places where there's an assumption that care is happening is in jails and prisons. And even in that, what we know is that incarceration is making our folks worse. That we know the research shows that if you have a mental health disability, the likelihood that it will get worse while incarcerated is certain. If you have no mental health history, the likelihood that you will develop what they call a mood disorder, anxiety, bipolar, major depression, doubles. And so the complexity in which folks are not only attacking healthcare, putting more resources into policing, into law enforcement, into incarceration, attacking pre-existing conditions while funding law enforcement and incarceration that produces pre-existing conditions is a complex assault on Black health and well-being.
So while the U.S. Republican-dominated Senate is trying to craft in secret their version of the Obamacare repeal, the DOJ is busy expanding the facilities for imprisoning more people and expanding the mandate for police nationwide to put more people in prison. You see those two things as intimately linked.
Intimately linked and generating each other. And I think that's a really critical point. If you care about healthcare in the United States, you have to care about state violence in the form of law enforcement violence in the form of incarceration. If you care about incarceration, then healthcare should be an issue because that's what we're going to, that's one of the structures we will need to really divest from the carceral system in the United States.
And what does that mean? You mentioned earlier we need to divest from the police system as well. So what does it mean? Because it may sound a little abstract to divest from police and to divest from the incarceration system. Does that even work? I mean, we have to pay taxes. We don't get to choose, sadly, that our taxes should go here and not there. You know, libraries, yes, police, no. So how do we divest?
Well, I think first we have to take the money that belongs to us. So, for example, in California, you have AB 109, which is essentially a law that has moved state prisoners into local jails. And with that, the state has given over $1 billion to Los Angeles County for reentry in particular, for making sure that folks, as they're coming out, have the resources and the infrastructure that they need so that recidivism reduces. Most of that money in Los Angeles has gone to the sheriff's department and has gone to probation, not to healthcare providers, not to housing, not to reentry services. And so let's start with the money that actually belongs to us. And so moving, I mean, we could all think about what could we do with over $1 billion over the last 4 or 5 years.
And so this was money that voters had set aside of our tax dollars. And you're saying it was meant to do things like mental health treatment for prisoners or release prisoners, and it's not going into that.
Exactly, exactly. And I think the same thing when we talk about changes and decriminalizing marijuana in California, those changes, those laws came with money. $10 to $50 million a year is the projection that should go to alternatives to incarceration, alternatives to criminalizing, particularly young folks. And so ensuring that that money actually goes to where it's supposed to go, into our communities and in places where we can control how they're being utilized.
So, Mark Anthony, how does the Black Lives Matter movement, broadly speaking, and it's a big term, how does that proceed under Trump? Under Obama, we had some very powerful acts of protest, of street protest. A lot of even non-black people joined their local movements. We're seeing much more outrage now, much more heightened awareness of police violence, which is some progress. Can that model continue, just at least in terms of the street expressions or social media shares, that kind of visible work to call attention to how Black people are impacted by police? How does that
Definitely.
proceed under Trump? I mean, can it
Definitely.
even work under Trump?
Definitely. And I think what we're looking at is a moment where we are working to protect, working to defend, and working to expand what we want. And really, and when I say what we want, I mean the infrastructure that we've built, the coalitions that we've created, the work that's been done and over the last 8 years. And to really shift the country to move and really understand that anti-Black state violence is a very real thing in the United States. And folks are getting a lot more, I think, creative and figuring out how we take advantage of this really intense pressure that we're under. You see that in the movement for Black Lives, Black Mother's Day bailout, where folks, Mary Hooks out of Song, in the South, came up with this idea that, hey, look, there's a conversation around bail in the United States and bail reform, but let's look at the way it's impacting Black women. And so let's focus on a day where we can bail out Black women as a way to expose the impact that this system has on Black women in the United States. And so there are a lot of creativity right now. There's a lot of important action that's being taken. And yes, our folks are moving and being diligent about how do we defend and creatively work towards our same goals. Our agenda has not changed. If you look at our vision for Black Lives policy platform, we still believe that those things are what's essential. And we're being strategic about what that means right now.
I mean, certainly this is an issue, as I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that's as old as the country itself. And so we've had liberal and conservative administrations, and it certainly remains to be seen how much out of the ordinary the Trump administration is going to be in terms of how people can operate under them, how protest works under it. Certainly, it seems to be one of the most extremist, if not the most extremist, administrations. Mark Anthony, give out websites. Where can people read the platform for the Movement for Black Lives, as well as the website for your organization, Dignity and Power Now?
Yeah, you can look up Vision for Black Lives policy platform. It'll come up. There's many folks, many organizations around the country that have endorsed it, and you can endorse it online at that website. You can get our Dignity and Power Now. We're a part of the Movement for Black Lives here in Los Angeles, and you can get us at www.dignityandpowernow.org and follow us there. We're also on Facebook, and we're moving and shaking locally to really push for decarcerating the county jail system in LA. Just to leave folks with a note that, LA is trying to spend $3 billion on building a mental health jail and building a women's jail. And we're saying that's actually counterproductive to what we need right now. What we need is alternatives to incarceration. What we need is to invest that money in real solutions, including healthcare for our folks, including housing. And so join us in making that work.
Mark Anthony, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Mark Anthony Johnson, Director of Health and Wellness for Dignity and Power Now, also a member of the Movement for Black Lives Policy Platform Leadership Team. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.